The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Not the least of which is the city government itself, led by Mayor Ed Lee. As gentrification has heated up, the city has deployed more and more police in the Mission District, which is really the epicenter of this process. And this has led almost immediately to a rise in police brutality, particularly against young men of color. And the most tragic case even ended in the murder of a man named Alex Nieto. He was a 28-year-old lifetime resident of San Francisco, and he was killed in a park in his own neighborhood. The only crime, of course, was looking suspicious. Additionally, the city has done everything it can to coddle the tech industry on one hand while pushing out the poor with the other. The Department of Public Works was even caught recently on video using water cannons from their street cleaning trucks to spray homeless people. They're literally trying to wash the poor people away. And this happened, by no coincidence, in the same mid-market section of downtown that is the home of tech giant Twitter. And Twitter landed in this neighborhood thanks to Ed Lee's Twitter tax break, the mayor's big program, which is basically a tax holiday for tech companies if they land in this neighborhood, which has so far cost the city about $6.2 million in tax revenue in just a couple of years. And then there's a number of private sector actors who have a big role in this, and I can't really go through all of them, but the biggest villains in the story are real estate speculators, who are actually the main reason evictions have been rising. It hasn't been individual landlords, it's been speculators. They've also helped to drive up housing prices because they come up to auctions, they buy houses with cash, well over asking price. So they help to inflate the market. And this also creates huge instability in the market because they're replacing potential like current homeowners who actually tend to live in the city. They're replacing people who want to live in the city with investors who are only trying to turn a profit. And then we can talk about the tech industry itself. And frankly, the tech industry really deserves its own talk, and I'm probably not qualified to get it. But I do think it's worth saying that the tech industry has to be called out for its extensive and often quite arrogant role in reshaping the Bay Area to suit its needs. Among other things, tech companies will blatantly violate all kinds of regulations. They'll avoid taxes, all in the name of efficiency or innovation, or their favorite term, disruption. And this obviously has brought them huge profits, but it's also added to the growing inequality and instability of work in the region. Now, fortunately for us, the tech companies and the speculators and the mayor are not the only actors at work. There's also been some significant reaction to gentrification from the community. For example, how many people here have heard of the Google buses? Okay, a few people. And of you, how many have heard of the Google bus protests? So a while back, tech companies started hiring luxury charter buses, aka Google buses, to ferry their workers from San Francisco to Silicon Valley, where a lot of the companies are based. And a not-so-subtle fuck you to the dwindling public infrastructure, they actually use public bus stops as their stops to pick up their employees. And any other private vehicle in a public bus stop could be fined $270. Of course, the tech companies have not been given a fine. Now, this had gone on for some time until last fall, after this started actually showing up kind of randomly at particular bus stops and then blockading the buses, using them as a place to hold public protests. So they blockade them, and then they do hold pickets, raise banners, or do street feed, or any number of things. And fortunately, I think a lot of the protesters who initiated this, they were very quick to put out call demands, not just around the tech companies or the tech workers, but use the protests as a platform to raise demands, broader demands around inequality. And this was kind of the real first time that the movement began to be kind of a widely recognized actual movement in and of itself. There have been since then several large protests in the Mission District around evictions, also around police brutality. There was a community-led campaign against the restaurant I mentioned, Locals Corner, and lots of successful campaigns that have helped actually prevent individual evictions. The unfortunate thing about the growing movement is that it has remained considerably fractured. A number of the actions, most of the actions are led by individual groups, mostly led by nonprofits, and they're usually only mobilizing their immediate bases, their immediate members, often in isolation from each other, though sometimes collaborating to some extent. That said, this activity has led to a number of really exciting policy proposals, and if you want specifics, I'm happy to talk about some of those ideas after, but next. So some exciting policy proposals, some that will show up on the ballot this coming year. But we have to acknowledge that their impact, no matter how good these policies are, their impact is going to be severely muted if they're not backed up by a broad grassroots movement of residents across the city bringing together these different organizations. And like I said, that sort of broad grassroots movement hasn't actually developed yet. Also, this strategy of passing policy to limit the effects of gentrification will, at best, limit the effects of gentrification. It will not actually stop the process of gentrification. So if we accept, like I have been arguing, that gentrification is the urban manifestation of these greater economic and political trends, particularly neoliberalism and the constant drive to maximize profit, then I think we have to fight for a solution that actually challenges those greater economic backdrops. And I think that's what this idea of the right to the city should actually be driven to, should be framed around. What this looks like in theory and practice, I can't say myself. It's still kind of an open question. Lauren's going to take it up in her portion of the talk next. I just wanted to throw out there that I think, as a starting point, I think it has to unite workers from across the city, from all sectors, in some form of organization, either at the workplace, but also in the form of struggles around evictions, things like that, also around issues of social reproduction, around universal healthcare, universal education. It has to bring together kind of a full picture of what urban working class life looks like. And at the center of it, I really do think that the main issue has to be housing and property, because that is, as I outlined very briefly, that is, I think, the real driver of this process of gentrification. And that's what we have to remove from the market and I think put in the hands of the people. So I'm going to stop there and let Lauren pick it up. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Lauren from Chicago. And as promised, I'm going to talk about this idea of the right to the city. So this expression was first coined in Paris in 1968 by a philosopher named Henri Lefebvre. And over the last decade, though, it's seen quite a resurgence and it's experienced this revival. And I think there's a reason for that that I want to talk about. But first, the main idea of the right to the city is just the concept that city residents have a right to housing, jobs, public space, water, sanitation, art, everything that, all the resources that the city embodies. But it's more than that. It's also that people have a right to transform the city and make it the city we want to live in. Not one that bankers and speculators want to live in, but in the process of transforming the city into the kind of city that we want and need, we will, in the process, transform ourselves and the way we relate to each other. So the idea isn't to simply expand access to the existing city, nor to return to an earlier version of a more traditional, idyllic city, but the idea is that we have the right to reinvent the city more after our heart's desire. So we have the right to do this. This is a strong claim, right, that we are entitled to remake the city after our heart's desire. And I think Lefebvre was not making a legal argument here, but a moral argument, a moral claim that human beings are entitled to remake the city and in so doing remake ourselves. So contrary to our contemporary understanding of rights as being something individuals are afforded, the right to the city is a collective right, since reinventing the city will depend on the exercise of our collective power over the processes of urbanization. So Lefebvre's book, The Right to the City, was first published in 1968 in the midst of a worldwide wave of radicalization and revolt. In fact, the book was published just before the historic events in France in May of that year, where student protests around the Vietnam War and other student quality of life demands were met with police violence, which triggered a student strike, which escalated into savage police repression by the police, and escalated into like a veritable battle on the streets, complete with barricades, and paralyzed the entire city. The students' willingness to fight the cops very quickly inspired young workers and inspired a strike wave, and ultimately a general strike that involved 9 million workers. And cities around the world in 1968 produced major revolts. So this is the historical context out of which the right to the city and many of Lefebvre's other contributions emerged. So coming out of like France in 1968, you can imagine why his work reflects a certain optimism about that another world actually is possible. It'll be difficult to exert our collective power over the processes of urbanization if we fail to understand it. So Lefebvre offers us a theory of urbanization about how the process is developed over time. And these contributions that made by OSAP have really contributed to urban theory and critical urban theory as we know it today, which in the 1960s, you know, Neil Smith would say, you know, was dramatically under-theorized at that point in time. So Fenn's hypothesis that he offers is that the planet has now been totally urbanized. Even the countryside and places that are like ostensibly rural are part of an urban regime. So agriculture, agribusiness, mining, mountaintop removal, fracking, etc., are all activities not done in cities, but are part of urbanization. So he wrote a book in 74 called Urban Revolution, and it doesn't describe a revolution of, you know, in 1968 or some former revolution, nor does it sort of foretell an urban revolution still to come, but it talks about this long historical shift from an agricultural to an industrial to an urban world. And concurrent with this shift is that with a shift in modes of production, there's been a simultaneous shift in the nature of cities and the spatial form that cities have taken over time corresponding to the modes of production predominant in that period. So he goes through basically like the original political cities of the ancient empires of Egypt and Mesopotamia to a more commercial merchant-based cities when merchants penetrated the system, the cities for the expansion of markets and stores and so forth. This city was replaced by an industrial city, which kind of coincides with the time frame that we generally associate with industrialization, capitalist expansion. And it was followed by the critical phase, which is the urban society, the point when industrialization is actually eclipsed by the processes of urbanization. So and this is the critical point where we where we reside, where cities are not to be understood as objects, he argued, but we should understand the totality of both time and space as being part of a long process of urbanization. So the dichotomies of city and countryside, of urban and rural, of core and periphery, society and nature, for him are false ones. All of these things are part of the urban fabric, which has become, you know, a totality. This is his argument. So Lefebvre's understanding of the urban sort of does represent a departure from the classical Marxist understanding of industrialization as the motor force of capital accumulation. So he would say, just like industrialization sort of smashed the traditional city, urbanization has shattered and superseded the industrial city. Neoliberal urban redevelopment is now, you know, a major strategy for economic expansion. Gentrification has become such a significant part of the global economy. You know, we see a reconstruction not only of North American cities, but, you know, Beirut, Shanghai, I mean, you name it, everywhere. The reinvestment and redevelopment of city centers have played a major force in the continuation of capitalism. So he sees urbanization not just a superstructure on top of an economic base, but rather a productive force into itself. So consequently, he saw the motor force of change to change this setup as being outside of the workplace and outside of the factories and offices, but in the experiences of everyday life of all kinds of people in their homes, in their schools, in their communities, and in their cities. David Harvey, who I'm sure many of us have read, was a contemporary of Lefebvre's and had a widely published critique of Lefebvre shortly after the publication of Urban Revolution in the 70s. And he argues that urbanization plays like a crucial function in capitalist expansion by providing opportunities for the profitable reinvestment of profit. So like Ronnie was saying earlier, if you, create $100 worth of value for your boss in an hour, and he gives you 10, that $90, what is he going to do? That it has to go somewhere. He has to either reinvest it profitably in order to continue the growth upon which capitalist expansion is based, or else growth, you know, faces a dead end. So this is, urbanization becomes the sink from which to sop up that surplus capital. And so for this is the mechanism that Harvey identifies as why urbanization is so inherently important to capitalization. But he says that industrial production still creates the conditions for urbanism rather than the other way around. but it does not supersede industrial production as the motor force of capitalism. So this is a debate. But though the origins of the right to the city concept were, you know, coming out of the urban unrest of the 1960s, like I mentioned, the right to the city idea has seen quite a revival in the last decade in, you know, academic circles, but also in broader social movements. And it has probably nothing to do with a French guy in 1968, but really with the intensifying assault on the qualities of daily life that have intensified in this period. The proportion of human beings living in cities has radically shifted in a short time. In 1970, less than 30% of humans lived on the planet lived in cities. That percentage rose to 40% by 1990 and 50% by 2010, and the UN expects the proportion of city dwellers to rise to 70% by 2050. So the world over, this mass migration has resulted in dual cities of luxury and misery side by side. Habitat International actually estimates that more than a third of people in the global south now live in unplanned squats and in shanty towns. You know, some of them are quite vast expanses with limited access to water, sanitation, medication, and so forth. A planet of slums, as Mike Davis called it in his 2004 book. So in the context of this, you know, global transformation towards cities, it's obvious kind of why the right to the city is kind of urgent relevance to people worldwide. But the right to the city concept, how many of you guys have heard this before? Okay, so the right to the city concept, you know, is actually employed quite widely by quite a variety of different actors at different scales. Some well within the narrow parameters of the status quo, and others which are incorrigibly revolutionary. The right to the city language has been incorporated into many international declarations and charters, beginning sort of in 1992 in Rio at the Earth Summit. But the World Social Forums, beginning in Brazil in 2001, really kind of expanded the international discussion around the right to the city. Now thousands of people and many dozens of organizations have signed on to the World Charter for the Right to the City, which was drafted in Porto Alegre in 2001, and including agencies of the United Nations have signed up for what I just talked about, the right to the city. Some city and national governments throughout the world have also passed binding legislation attempting to attack urban inequality and guarantee the right to the city through legal means. So urban social movements in Brazil, particularly housing, pro-democracy movements, after decades of struggle, succeeded in bringing the right to the city into federal law in 2001. So this city statute of 2001 prioritizes the social function of urban land and buildings above their commercial value, or if you prefer, use value above exchange value. The city statute also seeks to implement democratic city management. So this law represents a major achievement of the social movements for the urban reform movement in Brazil, but this legislation isn't in and of itself sufficient. You know, the overarching economic logic of the globe is the quest for profit. And while the markets incentivize construction of luxury housing and amenities, because that's what's profitable, it does not, you know, encourage construction of affordable housing. So those of you who are following the World Cup, you know, have probably been following the intense repression and displacement of the favelas in Brazil. You know, hours after it was announced that Brazil was going to get the World Cup, residents of the favelas were evicted at gunpoint, and there's even more like insidious maneuvers that the state has used to totally wreck and bulldoze entire communities of people, including, you know, basically paying people to move their neighbors out and really hiring the faveladores themselves to like destroy their own housing, which, you know, not coincidentally a tactic used in Palestine too, in terms of demolishing Palestinian homes. So there's actually a talk I'm really looking forward to tomorrow by Dave Zirin about the situation in Brazil. So there's also these multi-use or multi-issue coalitions of existing organizations representing, you know, a wide variety of subjects, homeless, welfare recipients, ethnic and racial minorities, immigrants, and so forth, who have created multi-issue alliances around the rights of the city in New York, for example, as well as on the West Coast. So this is all just to say that the way urbanization has continued to unfold, you know, both in North American cities and globally, movements for the right to the city are springing up and taking inspiration from the original text that that Lefebvre offered, but there's different understandings of what this man means and how it should be achieved. So I'll just conclude by saying that if we go back to Lefebvre's concept of the right to the city, because sometimes like the language is used in a sort of an abstract statement of theoretical human rights within the current, you know, existing economic and political system. But I think if we go back to Lefebvre's original concept, it offers us a radically positive vision for the future that's both concrete and metaphorical. It's about the struggle to access and remake our existing cities, but also it's a call for a new society. It's a call for a total transformation of the world we live in. So the purpose of theorizing the urban and theorizing urbanization isn't just for our own illumination, but to point out that the current trajectory of urbanization is not inevitable. Existing cities are built in the images of bankers and speculators, like I mentioned, and so surface modifications of these cities will ultimately not succeed in winning us greater access if all they're building is a new marina, a new hotel, a new stadium. We need to embrace the right to the city movement and look beyond the expansion of individual human rights as currently conceived, but really embrace the call for a new society based on exerting our collective power over the processes of urbanization and the use of society's surplus.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.